Welcome to the Science Podcast for February 10th, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, how plants detect UV light, mapping earthquake structures from above, and microbes in the home.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
During photosynthesis, plants can only use certain frequencies of light to generate food. Other frequencies, like ultraviolet light, can harm them. Elizabeth Getzoff and colleagues describe a unique protein in plants that detects UV light and initiates protective measures to mediate its effects. I spoke with her about the unusual features of this molecule from her office in California.
Plants, like animals, respond to sunlight so that the organism can act appropriately. And plants have the added handicap that they can't move around. So about the same time that plants evolved out of the oceans and onto the land, they developed a gene that's been named UVR8 for its response to a type of ultraviolet light called UVB light. So we were interested in how the protein that serves as the light sensor for UVB light, how it worked, how it sensed the signal, and what it did as a result of sensing the light.
So why do plants need to be able to detect UVB light?
Well, UVB light is what people use sunscreen for, and plants equivalently need to protect themselves from the light, and they can't go in the shade. They have to deal with the light wherever they are. So they can make chemical sunscreens and change the way their leaves behave in order to respond to UV light.
So you knew going into this study that the UVR8 protein formed a dimer and dissociated when exposed to UV light, but not how that light was causing this disassociation. When you look closely at the structure of this protein, what could you tell about its light interacting properties that you didn't know before?
Well, we found that there was a specific arrangement of tryptophanes, three on one side and one across, forming a pyramid, or actually two pyramids in the symmetric dimer. And those are the light sensors. And right next to those pyramids are salt bridges that hold the dimer together. So it's the combination of the light-sensing tryptophan pyramids and the salt bridges that hold the dimer together that allow this protein to sense and signal UVB light. So the first question we had when we got the structure was, did we have a biological dimer or not?
So what else did you see besides the fact that it was actually a dimer?
Well, we see these arrays of the tryptophan rings, which are big, bulky, flat things, and they're stacked within one side of the interface and across the interface, and they're also stacked with a lot of arginine side chains that also have bulky planar ends on them. So there's a lot of interesting stacking that's orienting the side chain.
So what you did next was mutate some of those residues and see which functions they were important for?
Correct. The tryptophan residues, most of them had already been mutated in Gareth Jenkins' lab because they're the side chains in proteins that are most sensitive to UV light. So he had already tested a lot of those and had identified some that he thought were important, but the missing piece of the puzzle was to see what's on the other side of the dimer. So there's three that kind of form a triangle on the surface of one subunit, but across from them is a fourth residue, which we called the sort of the apex of the pyramid. So we found not only was there the triad on one side, but there was a fourth residue across the interface that was interacting with them. And because this is a symmetric dimer, in other words, the two subunits each use the same interface to connect, that means there's two pyramids, one with a triad on the, you know, the A subunit, and one with a triad on the B subunit, each interacting with another tryptophan across the dimer interface.
And what about the arginine residues that you mentioned?
So arginine residues form multiple contacts as charged hydrogen bonds or salt bridges, And if they change their position, they can rearrange parts of structures. So they're often involved in domain motion or switching functions. So in our case, they're forming salt bridges across the interface and some within the interface.
So how does this all tie together? You know the dimer is being held together by salt bridges and that the tryptophan pyramid is responsible for the molecule's interaction with the UV coming in. What connects those two to get this signal to work?
We don't know all the answers yet. When you light excite a molecule, the electrons are excited from their ground state orbitals to a higher energy orbital, and then they fall back down from the higher energy orbital. So in the case of this protein, there's a phenomenon called exciton coupling that arises from having these tryptophan residues packed closely with each other. And my layman's understanding is that what's happening is the electron, when it's excited, can be shared by the orbitals of more than one tryptophan. So instead of having an electron that's in one tryptophan excited to a higher orbital in that tryptophan, it's excited to a higher orbital, and that higher orbital is shared with the neighboring tryptophanes. Hmm. So the electron is free to move around in its excited orbital more than it normally would be able to. And we believe that that allows the electrons to be released more easily. So the freed electrons from the exciton coupling, our hypothesis is that they're interacting with the salt bridges, and that causes the salt bridge, which is basically a negative and a positive charge interacting with each other, to come apart.
So this is a lot different than how other light-activated molecules work, right?
That's correct.
How is this different than, say, what happens in our eyes when a photoreceptor there is hit by light?
In your eyes, the photoreceptors have a bound small molecule called retinal, and actually there's a complicated procedure to synthesize that molecule to attach it to the protein, and it gets used up when you're sensing light and you have to put another one in. So that involves a small molecule, and it also involves the detachment and reattachment of the small molecule. In our case, UVR8 is a self-contained protein. It doesn't need any extra parts or things that get used up. It uses the side chains. It doesn't modify them in any way. It just uses the normal amino acids that make up a protein to sense light and to signal, and the signaling is reversible. So the signaling happens in the tryptophanes, the dimer comes apart, and the dimer comes back together on its own and can signal again.
And so when the dimer separates into its two components, they go off and do signaling activities.
Correct.
And then they associate again, ready to receive more light.
That's right.
You touched on this briefly at the beginning, but why do you think these plants have evolved such a different way of detecting light and maybe specifically UV light?
For a long time, studies have been done in both plants and animals on how living things protect themselves from UV light. And the reason this protein is named UVR8 is mutant plants were made that couldn't grow well in UV light. And then the genes that were defective in those plants were identified. And so UVR8 was the eighth one of these. So many of the UV protective enzymes are involved in DNA repair because UV light damages your DNA, and then you need to turn on some enzymes to make repairs because you have to keep up with this constant damage that's happening. But in this case, you're looking for not repair, but responses by the plant to environmental stressors.
Elizabeth Getzoff, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Elizabeth Getzoff and colleagues write about a UV light sensing protein in a Science Express article this week. You can find it online at www.scienceexpress.org.
Have you ever wondered how highway speed traps work? Speed guns employ a technology called LIDAR, or light detection and ranging, and it appears in all sorts of applications, including robotics, meteorology, and even music videos. But one of its most common uses is geophysical surveying. Michael Oskin of the University of California, Davis, spoke with me about using LIDAR to map the surface faults and fractures that followed an earthquake in northern Mexico.
This is about using a relatively new technology, LIDAR, to image a very complicated surface rupture from an earthquake and use that to better understand how individual faults link together to produce this large earthquake and similar types of enigmatic complicated earthquakes elsewhere.
Now, earthquakes are a very hot-button topic these days, and the particular earthquake that you studied is the El Mayor Cucapá earthquake in northern Mexico that sort of happened in early 2010 when there were a lot of other devastating earthquakes as well. So can you just tell us a little bit about this earthquake, where it occurred, and what we already sort of knew about it?
Sure. This was an earthquake in the Mexicali Valley. It ruptured in two directions. One, it ruptured up through the middle of a mountain range called the Sierra Cucapá, and then it also ruptured down through the Colorado River Delta. It was a surprising earthquake in that it didn't occur on one of the major fault systems that had been identified, although it did occur on several secondary faults, most of which had known to be active, and then it also occurred on some structures that were completely invisible or underappreciated. So it's one of these earthquakes that happens off of the main structures, these secondary structures, that's important because they come as a surprise, and if you have structures or cities built on them, they can cause a lot of damage. So this earthquake happened in a place that was rural or unpopulated, and there was very little loss of life in it, but there was a lot of damage to the agricultural region in Mexico. And because it happened in a very arid area, there's very little vegetation, and so the surface expression of this earthquake, how it ruptured to the surface and produced abundant scarps on many different faults, provided a very great natural laboratory to study the process of earthquakes and how they're recorded in the geology of the surface.
Right. Natural laboratory seems like a really apt term here. Mm-hmm. So now let's talk about this remote sensing method called LIDAR, or light detection and ranging. Our listeners may not be as familiar with that as they are with other things like gravity and magnetic surveying. So how does LIDAR work exactly, and what does it tell us?
Well, in essence, it's a laser range finder. So it's the same kind of technology that you can get a distance meter for playing golf or something, right? Where it measures the distance of something. But this is that technology mounted on an airplane and taking samples up to 100,000 per second. So it basically scans the landscape below the aircraft as it flies by at really high resolution. We were acquiring 10 points per square meter. And it produces this very high-resolution map if you know the position of the aircraft. So there's this LIDAR mounted on the aircraft. There are GPS on the aircraft and on the ground registering the aircraft, and then a unit that measures the acceleration of the aircraft to further correct its position. What's revolutionary about it is that it produces this scan at very high resolution over very large regions very efficiently. So we scanned 140 square miles in 2.5 days with 3.6 billion point measurements.
And then if you combine these images with data from another point in time, you can actually measure the change over time.
Yeah, there were two really exciting aspects about being able to study this earthquake with LIDAR. So we've been using LIDAR to scan active faults for up to about 10 years now. But this is the first opportunity to use LIDAR technology to scan a very fresh earthquake rupture. So there's a coincidence of having this earthquake in a good location for the natural laboratory and right next to the United States where we had the assets to go and acquire the scan. And then LIDAR technology in the last 10 years has disseminated globally, and it turned out that the Mexican government had flown this area at a much lower resolution, but with a LIDAR instrument just to produce a topographic map. It's a pretty efficient way to do that. And so we had this data that was acquired in 2006 that we could compare to the data acquired after the earthquake in 2010. This is the first time we were able to difference the topography over an entire earthquake rupture and look at the complete distributed deformation around faults.
Well, that sounds very exciting. So what new information did it tell you?
Well, what it tells us is, first of all, just completely imaging the rupture allowed us to uniformly map it out very efficiently down to within scarps along faults up to an inch high or so. And then we can compare that to measurements made on the ground. We also discovered evidence for entirely hidden fault slip beneath the young sediments of the river delta. And then with the differential LIDAR, we discovered this very surprising amount of warping between the individual faults that link together to produce this earthquake.
Wow.
So essentially what that warping tells us is that the rock mass surrounding the faults was pushed very close to the point of breaking. So, of course, it's breaking on the faults, but it's also pushing all the rocks around it very close to the point to make new fractures.
Hmm.
And that's very interesting. It tells us something more about just how well the faults can link together. Essentially, they're linking together and getting better at it every earthquake, but also something about how we grow other structures, like topography and folds around faults that we see in the geologic record.
Wow, how interesting. So what do you foresee as being sort of the primary use of this kind of data? Would it be more useful in seeing where stress is building up and predicting where an earthquake may happen next? Or would it be more useful in sort of predicting how an earthquake will propagate should it occur?
It's more useful in the realm of trying to understand how an earthquake will propagate. So in places that are fairly well exposed, arid regions in California and northern Mexico, we have identified a lot of different features that look like they were prehistoric fault ruptures. So some of these are along major faults. Other ones are sort of smaller features off to the sides or in between that we're aware of but maybe don't account for. And what this earthquake and others like it reveal is that these faults don't act in isolation. They link together to produce substantial earthquakes. And so by studying this earthquake, we can better understand that linking process and have a better handle on how to use those faults to better constrain where the hazards are. A related element to this is that what this earthquake revealed is that not all the deformation is on the faults, but when we have these disseminated, incompletely linked faults, there's quite a bit of deformation in between them. So some of that, in a sense, we're missing in our picture, but also perhaps means that it will change how we think about the budget of deformation and how it gets distributed across, say, the plate boundary.
Now, using this kind of data, this LIDAR data, seems like kind of a no-brainer in these earthquake areas. So why isn't this happening more around the world?
Well, there's a few reasons for that. First of all, in the United States, we've actually made quite an effort to image the major active faults. And it's part of the EarthScope project, and the San Andreas was imaged in the B4 project. So we do have sort of a before picture data to try to capture another earthquake. And also we're using that data just to better understand the prehistoric record of faulting along those various data sets. It's expensive. That's one reason it doesn't get done.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when you go to other countries around the world, a lot of those countries consider topography data to be secret. So it's actually not so easy to acquire and share.
So if all these factors are preventing LIDAR from being widely used around the world, what else can be taken away from the study?
Oh, I think this has very pragmatic applications. For one, we're going to be acquiring more and more LIDAR data just for all kinds of different purposes. It's a very efficient way to produce a topographic map. In so doing, we reveal the landscape at much higher resolution, and geologists can go in and interpret whether a fault is active and maybe even better measure how active it is. So as we refine that picture, and then we refine our understanding of a process of how earthquakes link together, that directly impacts how we model the hazard from a fault network, say through California or Turkey or anywhere else where there's a lot of hazard. Other things really could take away from this is that the expression and the record of how a fault is active depends a lot on its setting. So for this earthquake, for example, we had these faults that ruptured up through the mountain range, many of which have preserved evidence of prehistoric activity, and so we could have inferred some level of hazard there. In the other case, one of the faults that ruptured beneath the Colorado River Delta, it was essentially invisible. So that's an area where sedimentation is happening fairly quickly and burying the evidence of faulting. And so there's always going to be this hidden hazard component that we need to be careful of.
Well, what an exciting part of natural hazard research. Michael Oskin, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Michael Oskin and colleagues report on using LIDAR to better understand earthquakes in this week's Science. If you're interested in seeing what a LIDAR image looks like, a topographical map of this study area is freely available for download at www.opentopography.org.
Invisible to the eye, microbes coat our bodies inside and out. They also fill diverse niches in soil, water, and the air. Now, several research groups are investigating the ecology of microbes in the built environment, like our homes and offices. Courtney Humphreys, who writes about the topic in a News Focus this week, spoke with me about these efforts to explore the insides of buildings.
Scientists who study ecology have traditionally ventured out into the outdoors, and that includes ecologists who study microbes. But there's this growing awareness of the fact that a very important environment for microbes is right under our noses. That's been kind of ignored by science, which is the indoors. And that's where we spend most of our time, and it has a big impact, obviously, on our health. So there's a growing field looking at the microbial ecology of indoor spaces and of the human-constructed environment.
So more specifically, how is studying microbes inside different than studying them outside in nature?
Well, in some ways, it can be simpler because the environments you're looking at are going to be a little less diverse than, say, a rainforest or a swamp. But there's just a lot unknown about the indoors. We don't know what grows on different building materials. How do microbes move between rooms? How do they get from inside a building to the outside of the building? And just, you know, do indoor spaces follow the same ecological principles as other environments that have been more studied?
Huh.
Or are they unique in any way?
So you actually yourself participated in an indoor microbe survey. What did you find out about where you live?
Yeah, well, so I swabbed 10 surfaces on my apartment, which included doorknobs, door sills, my cutting board, toilet seats, and then I had the DNA analyzed as part of a new citizen science study. And there was only time for a kind of a quick analysis, but they found some interesting things, like the fact that my countertops had microbes found in tap water that could have come from my sponges whenever I cleaned the countertops. And there were cold-resistant fungi in my refrigerator, and there are just fungi everywhere, for better or worse. And the microbes on my TV screen were unusual types of bacteria that they didn't really know much about. So there's a mystery there about what can live on those surfaces. You know, is a TV screen a unique environment?
Huh. So you said this is part of a larger study using citizen scientists. And they're going to look at not just, you know, your kind of house, but different apartments, different houses, and maybe even different parts of the world. How will that information be useful?
Well, yeah, mine was the first sample they had sequenced, but they're now in the process of doing hundreds or even thousands of other samples from volunteers around the world. And the idea is to compare how microbes differ, whether, you know, depending on your environment, depending on your type of home and your geography. It's hard to know exactly what the practical implications will be, because right now it's just seeing what's there. But considering how much time we spend in our homes, and the money and effort we devote to cleaning them and maintaining them, I think it could be the start of a more science-based approach to managing our homes. You know, we have a lot of concerns about germs and mold and things like that, but it's important to know what actually lives there and why.
Mm-hmm. So this research is being done in predictable settings like hospitals, for example, but also some unexpected places like classrooms and public restrooms. What have researchers found out about the microbial inhabitants in those kinds of places?
Yeah, many of these studies are very preliminary, and they're just trying to get a sense of what lives where. But researchers are also trying to answer questions about how aspects of building design affect the communities of microbes in the space. So, for example, the biology of the Built Environment Center at University of Oregon, led by Jessica Green, did a large-scale ecological study of one of the buildings on campus. And they took dust samples and they collected air samples. And they want to see if they can actually model the way microbes are distributed throughout the building. There's a long history of ecology studies on islands, and they have this theory that buildings could operate almost like a series of linked islands. And so they want to see if the theories developed from studying islands could actually apply to buildings.
There's quite a few studies that you wrote about, but one reports that people actually leave behind a microbial impression of themselves when they leave a room.
So this study is from Jordan Petchia at Yale, and he's trying to understand how bacteria move through air. There's a lot of research on indoor aerosols and particles inside buildings, but not so much on microbes. And we're actually, humans are constantly shedding bacteria from our bodies. But when we walk into a room, we also pick up a lot of material from the floor, which is called resuspension. And so his team sampled the air in classrooms that were either occupied or unoccupied. And then they just calculated the number of bacterial cells in the air that each person is responsible for. And it was actually quite a lot, like 35 million cells per person per hour.
Wow.
So this kind of information can be important to figure out how we should be ventilating rooms based on their occupancy. And it also kind of highlights the fact that a room has a memory of past occupants, because those bacteria from the floor that you're kicking up could have been shed by someone the day before. So you're constantly being exposed to all these different bacteria from different people.
So it seems like there's a lot of data being collected, you know, from various places, various studies. Is there a coordinated effort to share this information between these groups?
Well, a lot of this research has been funded by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, which has a program on the ecology of the built environment. And they're really trying to foster this as a new field. And one of the challenges is that researchers are coming from different backgrounds. There are the microbial ecologists, as well as indoor air scientists and building engineers. And another issue is that it's very data intensive. The microbial world is huge and diverse, and so every study is yielding lots and lots of DNA sequences. There are different ways to analyze them. So the Sloan Foundation is trying to further connections between people by funding a consortium of researchers and some databases that they can all share. But it's a challenge because it is a really diverse field right now.
And so is anyone else funding this research? Is NSF or NIH interested in it?
Well, I think the Sloan Foundation has really taken the lead. Their hope is that by kind of launching all these studies, they're going to eventually get a lot of government funding for these kinds of studies. But right now, it's a little bit trying to prove itself as a field.
Courtney Humphreys, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Courtney Humphreys is the author of a news focus on indoor ecology this week in Science.
We will be back with stories from our online news site next week. In the meantime, check out the latest news at Science Now and the policy blog Science Insider, both at news.sciencemag.org. You can also join Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday afternoon. Today's topic, the science of love. Check it out at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the February 10th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.